Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Tuesday, April 14th. I'm Olivia Rose. The Alaska House approved its version of the state budget yesterday afternoon. The budget passed along caucus lines with all 21 members of the Democrat-heavy bipartisan majority voting in favor and all 19 minority Republicans opposed. The budget underwent some major changes on the House floor, most notably to the permanent fund dividend. It came to the floor with a roughly $3,800 dividend, contingent on a supermajority vote to draw nearly $1.5 billion from the state's main savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. But in a dramatic vote Friday night, three minority Republicans voted with the majority to eliminate the savings draw and the $3,800 dividend from the budget. One of those was Ketchikan Representative Jeremy Bynum, who says the state simply can't afford it.
Maybe it doesn't suit being here in this body very well, but I've spent my whole career of trying to make sure that the numbers match. And when I disagree with what those numbers are, at the end of the day, they still need to match.
Fairbanks Representative Will Stapp and Eagle River Representative Dan Sadler joined nearly all of the bipartisan majority to instead set the dividend at roughly $1,500. It's far from the final word on the dividend, which will likely remain unsettled until the House and Senate agree on a final budget in the closing days of the session. But House Minority Leader Delaina Johnson, a Palmer Republican, says she'd rather set the House's ask much higher.
We're setting the price for Alaskans at $1,500, and it's just going to go down from there.
During the House's final debate on the budget on Monday, Representative Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat who led the House's budget process, said the $1,500 figure represented a sustainable dividend.
Now, I concede that this may not be the final word, but a yes vote reflects that, at least at this moment in time, we would like to pay $1,500. All in all, this budget prioritizes and values crucial areas impacting every Alaskan.
The House's budget also adds roughly $150 million to the state's budget for public schools and $10 million for student transportation as districts across the state struggle to make ends meet. Republicans opposed the budget on a wide range of grounds. Representative Justin Ruffridge of Soldotna criticized the majority's decision to craft a budget that assumes oil prices remain elevated in the wake of the war in Iran.
I think that the members who sit in these seats a year from now are going to be saying, man, what were those guys thinking? They really made a budget on $75 a barrel oil? Do we think that's reasonable?
The budget now heads to the Senate, which will consider the House's version, come up with its own draft, and set the stage for final negotiations in the closing days of the legislative session in May. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough School Board voted to close two elementary schools at their Wednesday night meeting in an effort to pass a balanced budget and pay off millions of dollars in debt. KRBD's Cindy Dauphiné has more on the decision and how it fits into their budget planning.
The board tearfully and unanimously voted to close both Fawn Mountain and Point Higgins elementary schools at the end of this school year. The decision is one that's been looming for years. The board restructured the district's elementary schools last year in an effort to save money. Ultimately, it wasn't enough. Now, with a three-year plan to pay back over a $5 million debt to the borough, and the state having threatened to withhold funds until the board balances their budget, the financial constraints have come to a head.
It's almost like every district in the state of Alaska does not have the funds they need to run the district to support their students.
That's board member Jordan Tabb. He says it's not a coincidence that districts across the state have all recently voted to shut doors in an attempt to meet constricting budgets.
You may look at what's happening here in Ketchikan and say, wow, Ketchikan isn't managing its money well. And we'll take the blame where it's due. But every educator and every administrator in the state has a choker around their neck in the form of limited state funding.
And he said, without changes at the state level, he thinks they'll be in a similar position next year.
course, we can't charge tuition. We can't run big sales. We can't go to the borough, and whether they'd like to give us more money or not, they can't. So we are sitting here season after season and year after year having less and less to take care of our children and watching a cascade of failures occur.
The decision to close the schools was pushed back from late last month when the board directed district staff to come up with a comprehensive school closure plan, one that includes where kids from Fawn Mountain and Point Higgins will go and how they'll get there. That plan includes centrally located schools they call learning hubs, and all K-5 students from the closing schools will attend Houtling Elementary instead. Closing the schools will save the district money, but it's not enough. The vote came after nearly 4 hours of back-and-forth discussion over how to balance next year's budget and what positions could be cut from where. Acting business manager Lisa Pierce said the budget presented Wednesday night was balanced but irresponsible.
I understand that it's important to put people in front of classrooms, but you gotta keep the lights on. And this budget does not have that. It is a balanced budget at the cost of the basic infrastructure pieces that are required to keep this school district running.
Pierce said, realistically, the budget was likely about $1.2 million short. She said there wasn't enough money set aside in the budget presented for non-personnel costs like utilities and transportation. There's also no buffer for contract negotiations. There was ample discussion on whether the district should reserve money for important positions that have routinely gone unfilled, like multiple school counselors or a curriculum director. Most board members agreed to axe the curriculum director position from the budget. Here's board member Allie Ginter.
In 3 years, we will hopefully be done paying this debt to the borough and could afford to add a curriculum director. But at this time, we can't even afford curriculum.
Interim Superintendent Sherry Bollert said central office and administrative staff are already stretched thin, and some positions that could get removed from the draft budget are crucial. She says she knows the board seemed to have a consensus that they've been fine without a curriculum director, but that shouldn't be the status quo.
If we had a curriculum director, they would be guiding us right now on these are the programs that we need to maintain because we've had a process and this is how these curriculum pathways go through schools.
Bollert also said after she finishes her contract as interim superintendent, she will not return to her previous position as principal of Schoenbar. One thing all board members seem to agree on: it's unreasonable to cut staff from Revilla Junior and Senior High School, the district's only alternative school. The budget presented Wednesday would cut staff at Revilla, despite the school gaining an additional grade in the next year. The board unanimously voted to not approve the budget in first reading. They directed district staff to fix the budget as presented to save an additional $1.2 million. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Sydney Dauphiné.
Alaska Airlines increased checked bag fees for most customers due to volatile fuel prices and global uncertainty, according to a Thursday statement from the company. The new fees went into effect last Friday. There are no changes for travelers enrolled in the airline's Club 49 program, which allows Alaskans to check 2 bags for free when traveling to or from the state, or 3 bags if traveling within Alaska. Alaska Airlines is among several major carriers that have recently raised bag fees. Jet fuel prices have surged globally following the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, causing airlines to hike costs and cut routes. For travelers flying Alaska Air, checked bag fees increased $5 for the first bag, $10 for the second, and $50 for the third, for new totals of $45, $55, and $200 respectively, according to the statement. The company said bag benefits for Atmos Rewards members and eligible Atmos Rewards Visa cardholders are unchanged. Alaska seaplanes can now use new proprietary approaches and departures to improve flight safety and reliability for Southeast communities when pilots can't see anything but clouds. KTOO's Alex Solomon brings us this story.
Patrick Ford descends through the clouds shrouding Juneau in a brand new Cessna 208 Caravan. The plane emerges from whiteout conditions at around 1,600 feet above the Mendenhall wetlands and glides gently onto the runway at Juneau International Airport. Ford is a pilot and the director of operations at Alaska Seaplanes, the largest commuter airline in Southeast. For For much of the test flight, he operates on autopilot, using an approach that automatically follows fixed waypoints in the sky.
Every one of these little star-looking guys is a different fix. It's just a three-dimensional point in space that you have to hit at a specific spot at a specific altitude. And it's basically just like driving down the highway, and you're driving the highway in the sky, following the markers.
The Federal Aviation Administration has approved Alaska Seaplane's new departure and arrival paths in communities across Southeast. Juneau, Haines, Cake, Sitka, Hoonah, Klawak, Wrangell, and Petersburg. A spokesperson at Alaska Seaplanes says the company spent millions to design and get authorization for the new paths. But since the expense was planned years in advance, passengers won't see fare spikes from this. The company's new path in and out of Juneau International Airport goes through the south end of Gastineau Channel. Ford says it allows pilots to drop out of a cloud ceiling that's as low as 580 feet above sea level. He says that increases a plane's chances for landing in poor visibility instead of turning around.
I'm sure you guys have been on a flight where you get halfway up to Haines and, you know, it's shut down at Eldred Rock and you have to turn around and come all the way back.
The new approaches and departures are paired with advanced GPS technology called Synthetic Vision, made by Garmin. A screen in the cockpit displays a computer-generated 3D view of the terrain, allowing Ford to see what's around him when there's no visibility. He says that's an advancement on what's called Instrument Flight Rules, or IFR, a set of FAA regulations that control the conditions for pilots relying on instruments to navigate rather than sight.
So it's a huge, huge improvement in safety, and I sleep better at night knowing that that's an option.
Especially in Southeast, a notoriously cloudy and mountainous region. Large jets don't land in many small towns in Southeast, so residents rely on small commuter flights for air travel. Sean Quim is the co-owner and chief operating officer of Alaska Seaplanes. He says that before commuter aircraft could fly in low visibility, flights were frequently canceled.
So we just had to stay low below the clouds and wait for good weather, and you could go when it was good enough.
He says the new flight paths and synthetic vision will improve flights for outlying communities, like Hoonah, where he grew up.
It really allows us to be providing a more reliable service to the communities throughout Southeast.
Quim says there should be fewer flight cancellations. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
At least three cruise lines have changed their itineraries this year to avoid the Tracy Arm Fjord south of Juneau. The companies cited safety concerns brought on by a landslide there last August that triggered one of the largest tsunamis on record. As the Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports, experts say skipping that area is probably a good call.
Carnival Cruise Line, Holland America Line, and Royal Caribbean Cruises have all notified customers that their ships will not be visiting Tracy Arm or Sawyer Glacier, which is located in the fjord, this season. The move comes after a major tsunami struck the fjord last August. Mike West is the Alaska State Seismologist and a director of the Alaska Earthquake Center.
Many different boats and observers rode out this wave and experienced it. The immediate assumption was that this tsunami, this local tsunami, was generated by a landslide.
The U.S. Coast Guard and seismic data later confirmed that assumption. The tsunami was likely more than 100 feet tall in some areas, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. As a result, the cruise lines instead have opted to visit the nearby Endicott Arm and Dawes Glacier. The company has said in emailed statements they've been closely monitoring the area and made the decision based on the state of the waterway and current geologic conditions. Royal Caribbean noted that guest safety is its, quote, top priority. Wes says it's a smart move.
Anytime you take the side of them, you collapse the side of a mountain. I think it's a safe assumption to assume that you've got an unstable mountainside. It is perfectly reasonable or geologically reasonable that there could be follow-on activity.
Put simply, he adds,
you know, the Earth is getting used to its new arrangement.
Still, he says, it's not necessarily fair to assume that other deep, narrow fjords are any safer. Landslide and tsunami risk is widespread in Southeast Alaska, and scientists have no tangible way to quantify that risk in specific areas. Dave Snyder is the tsunami warning coordinator with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He echoes West Point, noting that two of the largest tsunamis on record have happened in the region. One was last year's event in Tracy Arm. and the other happened in 1958 in Lituya Bay near Glacier Bay National Park. Snyder says the two events had the highest run-up numbers, or high water mark left on land, in recorded history.
They are extraordinary, unusual events that can happen with little to no notice at all. And because of that, we have to stress those natural hazard warning signs that very well could be the only alert that you get during an event like that.
Those signs, he says, could include frothy or gurgling water, prolonged strong shaking, or a roar from a nearby hillside. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
For KFSK, I'm Olivia Rose.